I'm Darren Levy, and this is Citywide, airing every Tuesday evening from 7:30 to 8 p.m. right here on WNYU 89.1 FM New York and WNYU.org, New York University Radio. Citywide features insight with some of New York's most innovative artists. Today we are talking with Edward Rueda. He was a tour guide at the Uptown Art Museum, the Hispanic Society of America. And now, here to talk with us is Edward. All right, so we have a very special guest today here on Citywide. Edward, who is a graduate student here at NYU in the journalism department, but more importantly, what his claim to fame is he was a museum tour guide.
That's right. I was a docent, and I was an intern for the Education and Outreach Department in the Hispanic Society of America.
Thank you very much for joining us here on Citywide. Why don't we begin by just having you tell us about what your job was as a tour guide.
Certainly. As a tour guide, the woman who ran the education and outreach department then described it to me when I first interned there. She said that you're acting like an ambassador of the museum for the outside community. And what your job is to connect with the particular group which you're leading around and to cater your tour for the interests of the people who are coming through. Obviously, I would give a different tour for a group of senior citizens or similarly, you know, visiting dignitaries. I would give a much different tour than what I would give for elementary school kids or similarly, you know, elementary school, I give a different tour than high school students. There's different levels. For whatever reason, older people can tolerate being talked to, whereas with younger children, you need to engage them more often, you know, have them answer questions, have them ask the questions, point out things. You're slowly changing your spiel to what the group wants.
It sounds like there's a whole art form of its own right there.
Yeah, it's sort of off the cuff fly, you know, you cater to their needs.
Cool. So why don't we begin talking a little bit about the museum, the Hispanic Society?
Certainly. I think the problem with the Hispanic Society of America is that it's one of New York City's best-kept art secrets. It's in it's located on West 155th and Broadway, and straight in the heart, or the lower part, rather, of Washington Heights. And what's incredible about this place is that it's a 100-year-old building. I think it'll be 100 years old next year, and it's this huge palace, really. It's built in a Renaissance style, and it's completely free, and it's open Tuesday through Sunday for most of the day. So here's this huge free art resource. It's filled with so many famous painters: El Greco, Goya, Picasso. It has a world-class library. But the problem is it has very, very few visitors, because few people are willing to go that up north to go to a museum. And similarly, other uptown museums, the Cloisters, the Hamilton Grange, and a few others which I'm forgetting, face that similar problem of getting people to attend. So I think it's important to just tell people that this place exists, that it's free and that it's open to the public. So,
well, yeah, it's definitely hard to get a lot of advertising when you just let people in for free.
Right.
Do they have memberships and all that?
Well, no. It's they have a board of trustees, and that includes a lot of prestigious Spaniards and Americans. I believe the Crown Prince of Spain is one of the trustees. He comes in every few years. It's a completely free institution, and that's actually a good way to talk about the founder, because that's the way Archer Milton Huntington, the rich nabob who created this museum, wanted it to be. He founded it in 1904. He wanted it to represent the cultures of Iberia, Spain, Portugal, and their colonies throughout the world. And he wanted it to be a free library and museum for all to come in and to use as a public resource. And it was very visionary of him to do so, because in his time, especially, you know, this guy was born in 1870. He was son of a robber baron who ran the Central Pacific Railroad. So he inherited a massive fortune. He'd be the equivalent of a billionaire today. But what he wanted to do was to educate people and to build a museum. And there were very few museums in the United States at the time. So, and let alone public educational resources. So it was very visionary of him.
Do you think that he accomplished that vision?
He definitely did. I mean, the Hispanic Society is open today. It's world renowned among scholars of Spanish civilization. For art, it's second to the Prado. For literature and historical resources, it's very, very unique. They have parchments from the medieval period up through 20th century literature. So it's definitely a, he definitely accomplished it being a world-class educational resource. I think the big problem is reaching out to the larger community is where the museum has issues. But.
Well, with all this history and this prestige, were you honored to be able to be a tour guide?
Certainly. And I was really surprised to find out about it. My parents visited it a few years before I became involved, and they told me about it, and I sort of put it in the back of my mind. And then my junior year, I did a paper because I was a Latino studies major at Columbia, and it was a paper about different museums in New York and how they represented Latin American civilization. So I went up to the Hispanic Society, was a little misled by the name, because Hispanic in 1904 meant referring to Spain and the Iberian Peninsula. But I was amazed to find that it was that it was the way it was. I first came to the museum on their centennial party of all days, and I talked to the curator, and I talked to him a little bit. He saw that I'd done my homework and about the place, and he asked me to be an intern, and I was pretty pleased with that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. And then you moved up from being an intern to being a tour guide. Cool.
Yeah.
Can you give us a tour of the galleries? An audio tour, if you will.
All right. Well, let's see, where to begin. The Hispanic Society is located on a piece of land known as Audubon Terrace, which used to be the land of John James Audubon, the noted naturalist. Huntington bought it and built up several large granite buildings, which used to hold a lot of museums, but then some closed down over the years. Lack of attendance was an issue. And two institutions are open there today. One is Boricua College, which is a college that largely services the Dominican community that lives in Washington Heights, and another is the Hispanic Society. So now we've got the outside done with. Inside, if you were to walk into this building, you would be surprised at the enormity. In the center of this building is a room called the Gran Sala, or the large hall, and it literally is a huge patio with a balcony and columns, and that divides the museum into two levels. It's a very large patio done in the old Renaissance style. And it's made out of clay tablets, so it's a very rich brown, which contrasts with the granite walls. And on the bottom floor, you'll see a lot of church art from churches all throughout Spain, and including one room which I'm quite fond of called the Tomb Room, in which it's two old tombs from churches which Huntington got a hold of, and he put the statues from the tombs on both sides of the room, and on one side it's this bishop's tomb, and so you see the statue of the bishop laying in state you see the tomb around him, which looks a lot like a cathedral. It borrows that sort of what's the term? Church spires. That sort of a look to it. It tried to recreate a church with this tomb. There's even a statue of God the Father, they call it, on top, this huge stern man. And then on the opposite side is the tomb of a duchess. And that tomb was done about a generation later when Renaissance sculpture was beginning to enter Spain. And so you'll see more motifs of flowers, little winged cupids, Greek columns, Greek patterns. It's sort of softer and more playful, and it looks like she's lying there as opposed to stiff. It looks more like a bed instead of a severe tomb. So that's a pretty part. I should point out at this point that Huntington only when Huntington was looking for art for his collection, he only bought art from dealers outside of Spain. He didn't want to rob Spain of its visual culture. So, but because Spain had a very violent history, churches would be attacked. Nobles' collections would be divided, and they'd go to dealers in London and Paris and New York, and so that's where Huntington went in the early 20th century to get most of his pieces. Upstairs, you're going to find a combination of ceramics dating from the medieval up through the 20th century. You'll find some archaeological pieces, which Huntington found from Roman times. He organized several expeditions in southern Spain. It's like, you know, a bust and of a god and a few other Roman objects, but it's best known for its collection of paintings, because it's from the so-called Golden Age of Spain, roughly 1500 to 1700, when Spain was a dominant world power, and it had some of the finest painters in the world of that time. And again, that's where you're going to find El Greco, Velázquez, some Goya, the biggies from Spanish culture.
Very fascinating. You definitely know a lot about the whole museum.
Yeah, I did tours for over a year, so yeah, like I'm still able to walk through it. And on top of it, besides this Gran Sala, mm-hmm. On one side is a room which was painted by a painter from Huntington's time, named Joaquin Sorolla. And Huntington loved his work, and he wanted him to paint the different provinces of Spain. And so it's these huge murals. They're probably 20, 30 feet wide, you know, 20 feet tall. And it's four sides to this room, and they show different regions of Spain, their regional costumes, their dances, their food, their culture. And then on the other side is the library, which houses some old maps and all the manuscripts and books from, you know, the medieval times through today. And that library, amusingly enough, is still organized by the old card catalog, so you have to, like, go through and, you know, find the little paper tab with the book you want on it. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's a lot of work to put everything into a computer.
Definitely. Yeah.
Maybe they'll get around to it soon.
Yeah, well, they're going to need money and time, so it's probably going to be a while before they can get it. That's one interesting thing about the museum, is that it really feels frozen in time. First off, because it's supposed to look like an old-fashioned palace in Spain, but also because the museum largely looks the way that Huntington wanted it to be. It still has the old cabinets from 100 years ago, you know, the old picture frames which he had paintings kept in. So yeah, it has a very old, majestic feel.
You're listening to Citywide on WNYU 89.1 FM New York. I'm Darren Levy, and I'm talking with Edward Rueda, who was a museum tour guide at the Hispanic Society uptown. And I think one thing that you brought up a lot during your audio tour was art and politics, how there was also the church, and how all those things were involved with each other and kind of got intertwined. Mm-hmm. Would you like to speak to that a little bit?
Certainly. First, one thing which you have to realize is that in traditional Spanish culture, society is ruled by three forces. There's the king, who rules over his army and his nobles. There's the church, with its hierarchy of bishops, cardinals, and its strong doctrine, which kept people in line. And there's also the traders and their money. And of those three, it was the king and the church who were the top art patrons at that time. The golden age of Spain, the 1500 through 1700, and even afterwards. And so art served two purposes. One was to enforce the doctrines of the church, and keep in mind, you have Europeans turning to the Protestant faith, so they're very concerned about keeping Spain Catholic, and you know, you have the Spanish Inquisition, which takes care of anyone who thinks slightly away from church doctrine. And also you have the majesty of the Habsburg, the ruling Habsburg dynasty, which ruled over most of the world at that point. So a lot of these so you're going to have two types of paintings in the Hispanic society, you'll notice. One is church scenes and the other is portraits of powerful people. And we have a lot of examples of both. A classic one, which is on that second floor gallery, which I told you about, is a portrait of the Duke of Alba by an English artist who worked in Spain. His name was Antonio Moro. And the Duke of Alba is portrayed in a full suit of armor. He's holding a large baton, and it can be seen as phallic if you want to, but more importantly, it's a direct symbol that he's in charge of the King of Spain's armies. And keep in mind, at that point, the King of Spain, Charles V, was also the Holy Roman Emperor. So he's ruling over most of Germany, Spain, the Netherlands, and the Americas. So he's trying to, you know, keep the world from being Protestant. And a few years before this portrait is done, the armies had just defeated the Protestant allies, if you will, in Germany. There'd be future wars, but for now it seemed like the Protestants were kaput. So this portrait shows the Duke of Armor Alba in his armor, black gleaming armor. He has a red sash across his chest, red being the color of the Habsburg dynasty, of the Catholic Church, and he's holding this very powerful baton. So this hyper-masculine portrait is just showing that, you know, he's the guy in charge. He has literally tamed the world to under the rule of Charles V. And then what we also have are the church pictures, and it's interesting how in different times in Spanish history, the same church scenes will be represented in different ways. For example, there's right next to the Duke of Alba, there's a picture, or it's on the same wall, and it's from the same period roughly. It's by the painter Luis de Morales, who is viewed as a very pious, devout painter, and it's called Virgin with the Yarn Winder. And it's the Virgin Mary, and she's holding her little baby son, Jesus. And Jesus is holding a yarn winder, which apparently is like a stick, which vaguely looks like a cross. And you look at it, and you realize that they're not looking like a mother and child. They're looking very staid, very classical. The background is all dark. Mary has this really sad look on her face, and Jesus it's very strange. Jesus is in his mother's arms, but he's sort of leaning away, and he's looking contemplatively at this cross which he's holding, and he looks like he's about to or he's pondering something in the distance. So that's one style. It's more based off of Renaissance art, which was trying to go for, you know, more restrained classical attitudes towards it. So the point of this portrait is that it's showing the Holy Family as this very dignified, almost distant, courtly portrait. And then next to it is a painting by El Greco, who's more slightly well known, and it's the Holy Family. We have Mary, Joseph, and Jesus. The colors are much brighter. The background is actually a blue sky, and Mary is breastfeeding Jesus, and she's dressed in like a rich magenta gown, and you know, Jesus looks more like a suckling baby as opposed to this, you know, this baby philosopher in the other painting, if you will. And that shows another way in which they were trying to humanize the church and to make it more
more on the ground level with everybody else.
Certainly.
So do you think I mean, do we see artwork like this today?
Well, the problem is that we don't really have our rulers and our church being the art patrons which they once were. Now we have private patrons collecting art, mm-hmm. and the more cynical people in the art world are going to say that, you know, they're more interested in name brands, if you will. These artists who have a style and it's in, so they want this style. So you're going to have less art which is trying to reinforce, you know, the structures of what the dominant power is, what the dominant religion is. And you're going to have more personal expression, you can argue, although one could also argue that it's art which helps reinforce this structure of the art market as the most important thing. I've always felt, and my art teachers have always said, that all art tends to be political, and if it's overtly political, then it's political, and if it's avoiding being political, then that's a whole other political statement of its own.
It's very true.
Keep in mind too that back then, art was also the primary means of communication, because literacy rates were certainly nowhere near where we are today, and also we have a mass media, we have television. We have photography, all these different ways in which we can convey reality. I mean, these people, if they wanted to tell a story, they had to do it through paintings, through woodcuts, you know, printed pictures, drawn pictures. This was their main way of communication. So maybe that also contributes as to, you know, why studio artists today aren't as pressured to do art that reinforces the power structures today.
You know, I know you mentioned many, many painters' names, but not too many of them are well known. Why do you think
that's sad?
I'm going to ask you why you think. Well, do you think that they're...
Goya has a brand of beans after him. That makes him kind of famous.
I mean, some of them. I know you meant you reinforced just a few well known people,
right?
But there were many. I'm sure there are many people in the museum that are painters that you know, aren't as well known. Do you think that were they well known when they were alive?
I'm very glad that you asked me that. Especially if we're Huntington did a large collection of Spanish painters who were his contemporaries, who painted, I'd say, between 1890 to 1920. And two of the most famous painters of Spain at that time were Joaquin Sorolla and Ignacio Zuluaga. Who's really heard of them today? And why aren't they as well known? For one thing, Spain for a long time had sort of a prejudice against it. When Huntington started up the museum, his fellow Americans, if you will, would joke and be like, "Oh, Spain has no civilization. It's a dead country, you know, there's nothing of worth there." Huntington thought that was wrong, and I think he very much proved them wrong. But as why these Spanish artists are not so well known, I mean, I read something about it this morning as I was preparing for this, and it noted how in the 20th century, the most forward-thinking artists of who came out of Spain, if you will, Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, they left Spain, and Huntington was only interested in artists who stayed in Spain. And also, Huntington wasn't much for modern art. There's no cubist. There's no abstract. There's not many abstract paintings. I think there's like one in the collection. So Huntington was looking at more of a 19th century salon painting kind of genre, and that was going out of style during Huntington's lifetime. It doesn't mean that it was bad art. If anything, there's some supreme examples, but it wasn't in the foreground of the art world, and so it's not among the list of names which you can easily rattle off, you know, of artists. And also, as I said, during the 20th century, Spain had a really violent, repressive history, and that made a lot of artists, Picasso, Dali, Joaquin Miró, and others like those, leave Spain eventually, mm-hmm, for other countries.
Well, it looks like we're going to have to wrap up soon.
Aw, man.
But before we do, I would like to ask you, what did you take away? Usually I ask, what do you want someone to take away with them after they go to the museum? But what did you take away after being a tour guide for a year? What did you take away from this museum that you hope will also, that you hope others will also take away from it?
Well, I guess if anything, it's that Spanish culture is very multifaceted. People think of Spain, they think of bullfights, they think of, you know, stuff like that. But what they don't realize is that Spanish culture is a composite of all these different cultures, which are all pretty well represented in the museum. You have the native Iberians, Phoenicians, Greeks, Romans, Arabs. Arabs ruled Spain for almost 800 years and had a very strong presence in Spain. You have the Visigoths and the Germanic barbarians. You have Jews. You have the Christian medieval kingdoms. So, and you have influence from French culture and Italian culture when the kings of Spain wanted foreign influence. So you have all these cultures making this up, and on top of it, Spain and Portugal had colonies throughout the world, in North and South America, in Asia, the Pacific Ocean. So really, it's this incredible mix of cultures, history, styles. I guess a good thing to end on is that when Huntington had his museum in mind, he wanted the viewer to be able to stand in the center of the Gran Sala, which I described to you before, the Great Hall, and he wanted you to simultaneously see all of Spanish culture in one view. And indeed, I think you can achieve it, because on the bottom floor, you have the more medieval sculpture and church art, and in the top, you have the paintings and ceramics from the later time. So it really is this encyclopedic view of Spanish and Portuguese culture. So that's what I take away from it. It's very impressive.
Well, you yourself are definitely an encyclopedia of culture and knowledge of the art, and I really want to thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Darren. Thank you.
For more information about the Hispanic Society, you can visit www.hispanicsociety.org. That's hispanicsociety.org. That's it for Citywide. I'm Darren Levy. You can email your comments about today's show to citywide@wnyu.org. Visit Citywide on the web at wnyu.org/citywide. We'll be back next week with more arts talk, but for now, keep it here on New York University Radio, because up next is experimental acoustic music with Heather on Outside. Thanks so much for tuning in. And from everyone here at WNYU News, have a great night.